This is a Triple J podcast.
Prescription pills, it was alcohol, it was ice, it was G.
That may be the view of young people, it's not the view of our government.
If I don't meet a girl, it's pretty hard to tell her that I'm uncontactable.
To connect, to have a good time, to dance it off like nobody's watching.
This is going to have an effect for generations to come.
It's hard enough to get opportunities to perform in regional Australia, but what if the music you're offering isn't country or pop music, but heavy metal? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up, we're going to hear from artists who are travelling 800 kilometres to play a gig.
It's quite a niche genre that, especially in heavy music, where you can only meet a handful of people and you've kind of reached your ceiling quite early on in terms of that.
Yeah, I really want to get into this chat. If you're in heavy metal in the country, tell me, how hard is it out there looking for gigs, locking them in? Do you think it's getting easier? Popularity's growing? Message in 0439 757 555. Also coming up, the struggles of being the first in your family to go to uni. We're looking at a study that's found if you are the first in your family, you're actually more likely to drop out. First, though,
Hack.
Children as young as 14 face the possibility of being jailed for life.
On Triple J.
Adult time for violent crime. It's the Victorian government's answer to youth crime, including home invasions, knife attacks that have been reported in recent months. Not everyone's happy with this plan, though. These new laws would mean kids aged 14 and over would face adult sentences like life in jail. The government says it's important to take a tough approach. Others are saying, though, it's way too far. What do you think? I'm keen to hear your thoughts on this one, especially if you are in Victoria. Message in 0439 757 555. Arianna Lucente has the details.
I'm going to start this morning's press conference a little bit differently.
There was a big announcement from the Victorian government today on youth crime. And the Premier Jacinta Allen kicked it off by reading an email she received by a woman impacted.
A 16-year-old individual broke into our neighbour's garage and attempted to steal their car. My husband and son did not hesitate to intervene.
She says her husband was stabbed 3 times and her son suffered a traumatic injury.
My family and I became victims of a heinous crime that has left us physically, psychologically and emotionally scarred and has profoundly affected our lives.
Like other parts of Australia, Victoria is planning new laws to tackle youth crime.
There are too many victims and not enough consequences. It's why Victoria will introduce adult time for violent crime, where the courts will treat children for these crimes like adults, where jail will be more likely and sentences will be longer.
Right now, the max jail sentence in the Children's Court for an offence is 3 years. But under the planned change, kids aged 14 and above could get life sentences for some crimes. Sonia Kilkenny is the Victorian Attorney General.
We will be moving to increase to life 2 offences, aggravated home invasion and aggravated carjacking.
The laws are still being drafted, but the Vic government says the bill will be introduced to Parliament in the next few weeks, with tougher sentences to come in next year.
The Making Queensland Safer laws. So these are the new offences that will be part of adult crime, adult time.
Victoria's adult time for violent crime is similar to Queensland's approach, which passed after the LNP was elected last year. Queensland's laws have been criticised by the UN for being incompatible with basic child rights.
Community safety must and will come first.
In Victoria, police say kids are more than 12% of all offenders, while they commit nearly half of aggravated burglaries and a quarter of car thefts. As the government sells its plan, the state opposition reckons it's not tough enough.
Adult crime, weak on time policy. It's a hollow policy because the government has announced that only 5 crimes will receive an uplift.
Meanwhile, advocates are concerned, like Narita Waite, the CEO of the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service.
We are a state now that is unforgiving, unflinching, and decides that if a child makes a serious mistake, they therefore forfeit their life.
The government says it has been speaking with victims of crime in the community who back its plan. But criminologist Dr. Marietta Martinovic at RMIT reckons the policy isn't looking at the evidence around youth offenders.
Their brains are not formed. They're much more susceptible to peer group pressure. They may not have positive role models.
She says it'll kick off a cycle of offending.
You know, amongst young people who've been in custody, there's something like 80% within 2 years that come back into custody.
The Police Association has been warning for years that youth crime in Victoria is getting out of control. Its secretary, Wayne Gatt, says his group's members are on board with the plan.
The government has finally got the memo. It has come to recognise that consequences count.
Hack on Triple J.
Ariana Lachente reporting there, and we've got a lot of messages coming through on this one, including people in Victoria. Someone says, I am Victorian, this is needed. Crime rate is beyond a joke at the moment. Another person says there should be adult time for adult crime. But then some more messages. This still doesn't address the need for rehabilitation or tougher bail conditions. Another person says it should be adult time for repeat offenders. And someone else says 3 years is a lifetime for a teenager. So lots of thoughts coming through on the text line now. We're going to move on, though.
Hack. Definitely from my area. I'm from the Hunter Valley. It's definitely encouraged to go straight into kind of a more labour job.
On Triple J.
University. Before you get there, you don't really know what to expect. You've got ideas of what uni might be like, but you're trying to figure out how you're going to balance all this new freedom with your study load. You're having a good time, but trying to hit the books as well. Maybe you're also trying to work. You've got one, two, three jobs on the side. And in that case, you might be relying on your parents for a little bit of advice. You might be asking them, oh, what did you do when you were at uni, when you were studying? But what if you're the first person in your family to go to uni? Do you think being the first one to get a degree, to go to university, get tertiary educated, is easier or harder? What are the advantages and the disadvantages? Message in 0439 757 555. The reason I'm asking is because some new research on this has some very interesting findings. Alice Angeloni's been looking into it.
I think it was easy enough until I got to the process and I didn't know how to apply and I didn't know all the processes.
Emma is from Jervis Bay, about 200 kilometres from both Canberra and Sydney, and basically always knew she wanted to go to uni. But there were heaps of unknowns because she was the first in her family.
Even what uni looked like, I just knew it was like this big place. You went, you moved cities to go here, but I didn't know what it looked like.
Emma is at UTS doing a PhD, but she still remembers starting out.
My mum was so proud when I got into uni, went to uni. My brother's also really supportive as well.
And while she reckons there's some advantages to being the first in your family to go to uni,
I don't think there's any pressure from your family to, like, perform really well. I think people are just proud that you're in uni.
She reckons there's extra challenges too.
Just navigating it and learning how to communicate with your professors and how to balance life and uni and what to expect from yourself as well.
Emma's not alone. In fact, new research from the University of Queensland has found first-in-family Australians are less likely to attend uni and more likely to struggle or drop out. It's found the enrolment rate for people whose parents didn't go to uni is 36%, compared to 59% for people with parents who did.
And we found that being first in family or being potentially the first in family is associated with almost the highest gap in enrolment rates.
Dr. Thomas Zions is the researcher and says uni for first-timers can be hard.
Factors like not really knowing how to navigate the system, not feeling that they fit in, and that's one of the issues that the universities should try to address.
And while unis officially recognise disadvantaged groups, including people from regional areas, First Nations students and people with disability, first in family students aren't one of them.
I think we could still do more to make it more equitable and to ensure that there are no gaps of this magnitude.
My mum's been really helpful kind of navigating uni. She used to lecture at UTS, so it's been like a weird full circle.
Johnny is also at uni. He reckons while his mum's experience has been helpful, uni has also changed a lot recently.
Especially post-COVID, all of our lectures, or at least all of my lectures, have been online and pre-recorded. I think that's a big point of difference.
Zara is another uni student.
My dad's a coal miner, my mum's a stay-at-home mum, and then now she works in a school. I think it's really nice that they still, even though they didn't have that experience, were still like, let's encourage them to do what they want to do.
She says she and her sister feel grateful that they're having an experience their mum never got to have.
There is a kind of living vicariously through me that I think she's getting. I bring home my assignments and I'm like, oh, like, do you want to proofread this for me? And to see the joy and excitement that even though she's not directly going here and she didn't go through this route, to see us doing that, I think really like heals something in her as well.
Hack on Triple J.
Alice Angeloni reporting there and hearing from you on the text line. Someone says, when you're the first to go, your family just has no idea of how much sacrifice and commitment it takes. Got another message from KT who says, I am the first in my family to go to university and I actually graduate this year in December. Getting into uni was a struggle for a lot of reasons, but not having that prior knowledge growing up on how to pursue higher education was a big barrier for me. Realising how many of my classmates had parents and siblings who could help them with the process or at least had an idea of what they were getting into made me realise all of the extra steps I had taken. I'm glad I can be a point of reference for the next generation in our family if they ever want to go to uni. That's really interesting, KT. I want to get into this chat a little more now with Dr. Sarah Atfield, who is a senior lecturer at UTS and looks into similar kinds of things. Dr. Atfield, thank you very much for joining us on Hack.
No problem at all. Glad to be here.
What do you think it is hard for some people to make the adjustment to uni if they're the first ones in their family to go?
I think it's hard because it's difficult when you don't have a point of reference. So when you're first in family, despite your family might be very encouraging of you going to university, they don't necessarily understand the systems or have come across the language that's used by universities. And there's a lot of assumptions made by universities that the students coming in will understand those systems and be able to be across all the different language. And it actually can be really super confusing. So if you've had no point of reference, you might not know the difference between, for example, a lecture and a tutorial or a seminar or a workshop or a lab or whatever it is, and understanding how to navigate systems and who to ask for help can be really daunting if you don't have anybody else in your family to ask about their experience prior. So I think that creates, you know, can create quite a lot of anxiety and be quite daunting for some students.
Yeah, it sounds like you're not too surprised by these results from this study then.
No, not at all, actually. Based on my own experience of having been a first in family student myself, and also and the experience of other family members and friends, but also my students, the ones that do come through, who share these kind of concerns when I chat to them about it. So I'm not surprised at all. It's good to see this kind of study come out, this research backed up with data, because that can be really helpful in providing the information needed for those who might be in the position to change policies or affect change. So I'm not surprised at all, but I'm very pleased to see it.
We've got a lot of messages coming through on this, Dr. Atfield. Someone says, I'm the first in my family to move away for university, but I had no idea how to manage my work and study load. I ended up dropping my degree and moving back home. I eventually finished a 100% online degree. We've got another one on the text line now saying, I work in a university admissions team and we give students who are first in family 5 bonus points, which can be added to their ATAR and help them get into their preferred course. I really think it helps to recognise these students may not have the support others do. And then Lainey has messaged in saying, I'm going to be the first in my family to go to uni next year and I'm shitting bricks. So Lainey, a lot of people can understand that feeling. I was the same, first in my family. I guess the flip side to this, Dr. Sarah Atfield, is maybe people might be able to use that pride that they feel being the first in their family to drive them to succeed. I know, like, while I was really daunted to go to uni, I felt like a bit of an obligation to get it done for my family.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And holding on to that pride and being really proud of your family and where you come from, I think that's really important. Especially if you start uni and your classmates are very different to you. You know, they have a very different experience. And making sure that you always feel that you've got something of value to contribute to your classes and to your studies in general, that pride is really important without putting too much pressure on yourself at the same time. Because if you're feeling like you've got to do this for your family, that can be quite a lot of pressure for somebody to put on themselves. So you are doing it for yourself as well. And you've got to, you know, try to enjoy it as much as you can.
Yeah, that's...
So there are positives, absolutely, to take out of it.
That's a fair point. You've got to take it easy on yourself. You're listening to Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Dr. Sarah Atfield from UTS. We're speaking about being the first in your family to go to uni, because there's some research that's out today showing if you are first in family, can battle it a little bit. Maybe you're struggling at university or you're more likely to drop out. Hearing from so many of you on the text line now, Aaron says, who's from the Country University Centre actually, says Clarence Valley, we're a regional study hub in Grafton providing support to anyone studying online. Most of the students we help are first in family and find our wraparound support invaluable in those first few years. It can feel like learning a foreign language, which is exactly what we're hearing on the text line now. So many people saying, I'm the first in my family at university. Dr. Sarah, how do you think we can make the system fairer for these kinds of students?
Oh, well, there's a few different ways. I mean, firstly, it should be free. That would help for a start. Mm-hmm. But it's not always just about the cost of university. It's about those kind of barriers and feeling that university is something for you to do. So I think having some input in education early on is really helpful. Universities can reach out to schools to meet with prospective students and to sort of plant the seed, I suppose, early on for kids who might not have thought about uni because maybe their families didn't go, but the seed is planted and then the idea of going to university becomes really normal, chances to visit campuses and that kind of stuff. And then having support in place once a student starts is really, really crucial, so that students don't feel isolated and sort of stuck on their own. So there are things that can be done in schools and by universities too.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Sarah Atfield from UTS. I appreciate your take on all of this.
No worries. Thanks very much.
And let's hear from Hack Listener now. Daniela is with us. Daniela, you're the first in your family to go to uni. How did it go?
Yeah, correct. I actually ended up dropping out.
Oh, no. What was the reason for dropping out? I mean, I shouldn't say oh, no. It could have been the best thing you ever decided to do to drop out.
Yeah. I think just the pressure with my family, you know, my parents started work after year 11. So I think it was, okay, well, you're only going to get a good job if you go to university, but they didn't understand how university works. So my sister and I kind of went in blind, like what you guys are talking about, which I think would be really good if you could help those people that are the first in their family, because I wanted to defer and my parents didn't even understand that you could do that or that I could change what I was doing because I didn't like it. And then it ended up, you know, just leaving completely.
So you reckon there definitely should be some like category that, you know, you can tick and people know that you are facing these extra challenges because you are the first in your family?
Yeah, 100%, because I think it is a great opportunity. I'm grateful now, like obviously I've got a great job, but it's taken me a few years to get there without university degree, but yeah. I'm happy. But for the young people coming through, I think it would be really beneficial for them.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling in, Daniela. I really appreciate you coming on. And a lot of experiences just like yours. Someone says, I was the first in my family to go to uni too, but if you're determined, you can do it. And someone else, Rachel, says, I was first in family at uni and it wasn't really an issue for me. I went to a seminar in O-Week to explain everything and I ended up meeting some really great people, which is good to hear.
Hack. The man accused of murdering 24-year-old Toya Cordingley, whose body was found on a far north Queensland beach, goes on trial today.
On Triple J.
If you live in Cairns, you're probably used to seeing this name every day. Toya Cordingley. A woman killed 6 years ago while out for a walk in far north Queensland. Now, this case shocked not only the local community, but the whole of Australia. The man accused of her murder is now facing trial, and the ABC's The Case Of podcast is keeping track of it. Host Stephen Stockwell is with us now to explain. Stocky, thank you very much for joining us on Hack.
Thank you for having me.
Can you remind us about this case? So Toya was killed on a beach about 6 years ago. What is alleged to have happened?
So Toya Cordingley was walking on a beach just north of Cairns on October 21, 2018. It was a Sunday afternoon, by all accounts, a beautiful day. She had her dog Indy with her and was walking up that, something she would do quite regularly, something that people in Cairns do quite regularly is just go for a walk on the beach. And she never came back from that walk. Her boyfriend at the time raised the alarm, got police involved, told her parents and told friends. And the following morning, her father actually found her in the sand dunes. He saw a mound of sand there. He touched the sand and it fell away, revealing a foot. And that was Toya Cordingley's foot. And, you know, he raised that with police. And then this search started for her killer. This was something that really kind of galvanised the Cairns community, and there was a big search for, you know, the person who was responsible for this. And now we have the man accused of that murder, the defendant, Rajwinder Singh, in court. He denies that. He's pleaded not guilty. Yeah, this is the trial to see if he's guilty or not guilty.
So what do we know about the accused?
So we know he lived in Innisfail, which is a town south of Cairns, and that he was, according to the prosecution in their opening, he was on Wongeti Beach at the same time as Toya Cordingley. Now, they have linked Rajwinder Singh to this murder through what they say are the movements of Toya Cordingley's phone following the murder, and then also CCTV. So they followed Toya Cordingley's phone leaving the beach. Toya Cordingley did not leave that beach, unfortunately. They followed her phone leaving that beach, and they matched that with CCTV footage. And that CCTV footage showed a blue Alfa Romeo, which they then linked to Rajwinder Singh. So they say when they found Toya Cordingley's body, Rajwinder Singh was on the phone to a travel agent. He was booking a one-way flight to India, and he would not be seen again for 4 years.
So, Stocky, what else have we heard in court so far?
Yeah, so we've had, that was the prosecution opening that was kind of taking you through. We've also had the defence opening. So this is the team that is representing Rajwinder Singh. Again, he has pled not guilty in this trial, and his team says he didn't do it. And something that they have highlighted in their opening were other people that were around the beach at that time. And something we heard in the openings was a description of the injuries that Toya Cordingley had. And I mean, this is just a quick warning that, you know, what was described was quite brutal. So she had wounds up the left-hand side of her body and then also slashes across her neck. And the prosecution said it was likely the slashes across her neck that were the injury that killed her. Now, in the defence opening, they were talking about the knife that was used. The prosecution spoke about, you know, a small knife potentially being used in that. The defence believe it was a bigger weapon that was used in that attack. And then they were sort of drawing a link between people who go pigging in that area. There's a number of wild pigs around the Wongeti Beach area north of Cairns, and they sort of drew a link between that as well. So that's what we've seen in the openings. It gives you an idea of where the prosecution and the defence are going to take their case, and that's all kind of backed up by the evidence that we hear throughout the trial. And then through the trial, we've heard from Toya Cordingley's parents, you know, them describing, you know, their search for the daughter in the day following her going missing, and then also from her boyfriend at the time, Marco Heidenreich.
So do we know how long this trial is going to go for?
We're looking at the moment of 3 to 4 weeks. You know, I was looking at, you know, some of the people who are likely to be appearing, and I thought 3 weeks was, you know, pretty optimistic for that. But they have been moving through it quite quickly. We're doing quite long sessions in the morning and afternoon. So, yeah, at the moment, looking at 3 to 4 weeks.
What's the kind of vibe in the community, I guess? You're there. Is there still a lot of interest in this case?
Yeah, there is. I mean, this is a case that, you know, was a long time ago. This happened in 2018, and there was a big public campaign at the time. You know, you can look around, you know, Cairns and see these bumper stickers with Toya's name on them still. And, you know, it's something that you may expect or anticipate a bit of fatigue around, but it's not something that I've seen certainly in the courtroom. I mean, the public gallery in the courtroom that we're at in the Cairns Supreme Court is almost completely full. So there's a lot of interest in the case there. And, you know, when I'm talking to people around the community about it, there is that interest, there is that engagement in it as well. And I mean, it's something that is so close to this community. I realized this morning when I was walking down one of the streets in Cairns that I saw a coffee shop and I recognized the name. And I thought, hang on, why do I know that name? It's because we've seen CCTV footage, you know, shown during the opening of Toya Cordingley walking past that coffee shop the morning that she went missing. So, you know, it's really closely tied to just life in Cairns generally, and people are really interested in the outcome of this case. And it's something as well that I think, you know, really resonates with people all over the country. You know, this is a woman going for a walk with her dog on a Sunday afternoon. And, you know, I think a lot of people are resonating with that.
And for people who do want to follow this trial, how is it working, the podcast? Like, how often are you going to be updating?
So we're doing episodes at the moment every Tuesday and Thursday. So I'll be producing an episode tomorrow morning with Chris Tester, the ABC Far North reporter who I'm working with to cover this trial. Grab the ABC Listen app, search for the Case Of podcast on there or whatever other podcast app you're using.
Stephen Stockwell from the Case Of podcast, appreciate you coming on.
Thank you.
Hack! The music out in country towns ends up being just different to cities. I can't explain why. I guess it's ways different out here.
On Triple J.
Have you ever been to a heavy metal show? Because it's a popular genre of music growing really fast in Australia. Obviously with festivals like Good Things, Not Fest, Park Waves, bringing thousands of moshing fans together. It's any young band's dream to play on a festival stage like that. But for metal bands in the regions, it's really hard. Like, you're going to hear in a minute from a band in the remote far west part of South Australia who are facing an 800k trip just to play a gig in a capital city. So what are the challenges of loving one particular kind of music so much but not having anywhere near home to enjoy it? Duncan Bailey has this story.
In the quiet town of Ceduna on South Australia's far west coast, the shriek of guitars and beating of drums echoes throughout the old Scouts Hall. Callan's 20 and the lead guitarist of Gnaw, Ceduna's only heavy metal band.
People tell me, oh, you play this sort of music, you should go and talk to this guy. And you talk to him and say, oh, let's play some music. And then it just snowballs from there.
Callan dreams of playing big festivals, but that dream can feel a long way away because Ceduna is almost 800 kilometres away from the nearest capital city, Adelaide.
A round trip from here is around 16 hours, and doing that sort of a trip for a 40-minute show to some people might seem a little extreme, but you know, for us, it's a thing we've got to do.
Callan reckons there's a fair bit of local music in Ceduna, but there aren't many options for metal bands.
It's all more so around the sort of poppy, more country side of stuff, so it's hard to end up on the same bill as a lot of that sort of thing.
And with their first capital city show coming up in Adelaide, Callan reckons the distance is just part of life on the west coast.
Even just getting the name out there in bigger places where people will see us is going to be difficult, but I don't know, as long as we stick with it, which we're planning to, we should get there eventually.
400 kilometres south of Ceduna and Port Lincoln, Mike Pearson is gearing up for a busy summer of shows.
Any venue in the regions is important, and the alternative ones obviously are great to sort of showcase some different genres, different types of music and original music at the same time.
Mike's venue, Sound City, sees artists crossing through Port Lincoln from all over the country, travelling east and west.
It's sort of the nursery for the whole music industry, so this obviously reducing the number of venues that alternative bands can play in, well, the obvious effect that they've got nowhere to play, so they sort of have to invent their own gigs.
Mike says while festivals are often something bands like Callan's aspire to play in, without local venues, those festivals won't exist.
Festivals make more well-known bands more accessible to more people, I suppose, by virtue that a festival will have bigger capacity, so they'll be able to get more revenue from ticket sales and be able to afford bands. What it does for the local industry, I guess any exposure to music is a good thing, and people realise the advantages of seeing live music, then the flow-on effect has to be good for local venues as well.
Bringing you the best in hard and heavy music, this is Core.
Jack Bergen is the presenter of Core, Triple J's flagship heavy music show. He also has more than a decade of experience touring as the vocalist for hardcore outfit Void of Vision. He reckons it can be hard for regional bands to find their audience, and lots end up moving to the city.
I think it's very limited what you can do in a regional town. There's only it's quite a niche genre that, especially in heavy music, where you can only meet a handful of people, and you've kind of reached your ceiling quite early on in terms of that.
But he's noticing metal make a comeback in the country.
I know that regional touring in a larger aspect for some of our more household names is coming back big. If we can keep continuing to sort of reintroduce these smaller towns and have more of these flagship acts come through, a lot of the locals will see that and they will respond to that.
For the fellas in Gnaw, the distance across the regions isn't enough to keep them from trying to work their way into the spotlight.
I don't think we've gotten to the too much or too expensive part yet, but even if we do, I don't think we're going to be that fussed. I think we're just going to keep doing it. I think we're all wanting to do it enough that we'll just try and work through anything we can.
Hack on Triple J.
Duncan Bailey reporting there. Production support from Alice Angeloni. Also additional support from Harry Bailey too. We've got a lot of messages coming through, not only on that story, but also some of the other ones that we've covered on Hack today. There's been quite a few. The adult time for violent crime story earlier. Victorian government's plans to crack down. Someone says, I'm a Victorian. Youth crime won't change unless they remand them instead of letting them out on bail. Another person, Alex in Geelong, says, fully agree with this approach. Enough is enough. These people should be held accountable regardless of their age. Also, a lot of comments on being the first in your family to go to uni. Someone says, I was the first in my family to go to university. I did 3 years and dropped out and became an electrician. And someone else says, I was the first in my family and definitely felt the pressure. I failed my first degree, didn't tell them, then diverted to a different degree and I passed. All right, that's all for Hack for now. Abby and Tyrone are back with you now. I will catch you tomorrow. See ya. Hack.